This is Jeff Cloud of Velvet Blue Music, and you're listening to my chapter of As the Story Grows.
What would you say
you do here?
Have a good time all the time.
Dominate.
Who's got it better than us?
Nobody!
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
I want you to be realistic.
What do you love about music?
I am being realistic.
As the story grows.
I always wanted to be part of a small rebellion.
You got this, Travis. Make them wait for it. Boom.
Yeah. Maybe we'll start there. Scott wants me to ask you about growing saffron. That was the first question Scott wanted me to ask you.
Okay, no problem. I'm currently growing saffron. For some reason, Hatch and Mr. Martin find this to be a point of great humor, so they text me about it often. But my wife's dad is from Brazil, and so he is very into, like, saffron rice and saffron chicken and those kind of things.
Okay.
So I really was never accustomed with the spice until I married my wife, and then, you know, we're always buying saffron, but the stuff is, like, quite literally, like, more expensive than cocaine. It's, like, just ridiculously expensive to buy, like, 10, 15 strands of saffron. So, I don't know, one night when I was with, I don't remember who I was with Hatch or Martin or one of them, and I said, you know, I'm just going to start growing saffron. It's ridiculous. So, I did. I started growing it, and last year it was successful. The problem is, why it's so expensive is because each saffron, it grows like a little sprig of grass. It produces one flower, and then that flower produces two strands, which is basically the equivalent of two hairs of saffron. And then you get two strands out of each flower. So you basically need to have, like, hundreds of flowers. I personally only have, like, 15 or 20, so it's just kind of fun. But I know they find great humor in the idea that I'm growing it. But, yes, I'm growing saffron.
Set low your expectations. The secret to happiness is there. Contrary to all you think, the key is underselling.
All right, man. So I was trying to think about, I've, like in abstract, I've bought records from you for a long time and, like, been a fan of, like, bands you've been in for a long time. And I was trying to think about the first time I either saw you live or encountered you as a person. And the thing that first came to mind is I think it was Purple Door Festival 2000. Where you played back-to-back sets. You played in Starflyer, and then you played in Joy Electric, back-to-back sets. And it wasn't... The thing that sticks out in my mind is not that you played back-to-back sets, or not that, like, the crowd decided they were going to have a mosh pit and tear down the fence while Joy Electric was playing, but it was while you were setting up for Joy Electric, you had a theremin, and the wind was blowing that day, and the wind kept making the theremin make music, and it was, like, frustrating you to no end, and that always has stuck out in my mind for some reason. So that is my first, like, Jeff Cloud memory of you trying to get the theremin to stop making music for whatever reason. It's a weird thing.
Yeah. No, I mean, I loved the theremin. It was really fun to play with. Actually, honestly, kind of hard to control. And if you've ever seen anyone who, like, legitimately plays the theremin, it is kind of mind-blowing. I mean, it does take a little bit of talent to, like, make that thing do what you want to do.
Yeah, I owned one for a few years, and then I did not have any use for it, so I sold it. So,
yeah. I mean, I just did fun things with it, but I had no, like, true talent of making it do what you're supposed to do.
Yeah, I feel like that year you guys had a lot of way more synthesizers than you needed for your set, but that was my perspective as just a fan.
Yeah.
So there's so much to talk to you about because you were in Joy Electric and Starflyer at what I would consider, at least from a fan perspective, the quote-unquote height of their careers, and you have this long history owning Velvet Blue Music. So there's so much to dive into, but let's just start back at the beginning, and we won't get into, like, growing up and household life, but I'm curious about what got you into music in the first place.
I always loved music. To be honest, I have an older brother who's a lot older than me. He's like 10 years older than me. So he was always really into music, like more like, you know, like Led Zeppelin, like rock and roll kind of stuff. But
yeah,
because he was into music, I then in turn became into music. And then sort of during the height of like 80s stuff, you know, he was into all that kind of like new wave stuff. And so to me, it was just super weird, but he liked it. And then I just kind of liked it. So we always had a lot of music in our house. And then growing up, you know, obviously through junior high school, I don't know, some people lean on different things. I always just leaned on music. I didn't play sports. You know, I went home, I listened to records, or I was excited about buying new records or finding a new band, or it's just always been something in my life. And I don't know, there's some sort of weird comfort to it. And, you know, you can always come home and throw on a record and reflect or hang out, or I don't know, it's a fine line between kind of relaxing or, you know, being maybe a little introspective and thinking about things or whatever. And so I just always liked music, and I was I always kind of knew I wanted to start a record label. Even when I was like in high school, that was kind of, you know, always turning in the back of my mind. So I don't know, it's just, that's just what I did. And then, you know, by default, you just surround yourself by those kind of people, you know what I mean? Like, if you play baseball,
yeah,
pretty much probably your friends play baseball too, and you go to baseball games, you know? So when you like music, your friends kind of like music, or they play music, and you go to shows or whatever. It's just all relative. I don't really know why. It's just kind of something I chose to be into.
Is there a record or band that was like the it moment for you, where you were like, that stands out as like, they defined your life more than any other band?
I mean, it's all relative to like different times in my life. You know what I mean? I mean, the band I was like really, really into when I was like, you know, kind of a punky kid when I was like 13 or 14 or whatever. I mean, I was just listening to Misfits all the time. And to me, it was like, oh my gosh, this, you know, this is just freaking crazy. They're these ghoulish, dark guys. They're making all these like 50s kind of jams. It's all just, I thought it was something super cool and unique and crazy at the time. And so regardless of what it's derivative of or how horrible the sound quality is, or when I listen back to it now, at that point in time in my life, I'm like, man, this is just awesome, you know? So
yeah,
I mean, that's where I started out, which is kind of like punkier stuff. That's, you know, whatever. That's, I think most kids do. But this is kind of what I was into when I was a teenager.
That's cool. That's interesting. I don't know that I would have pinned you as like picking the Misfits or punk is like your starting point, dripping off point. So that's interesting.
It's just a point in time where I was like, you know, skateboarding was really big, and for some reason music and skateboarding were really intertwined. So for me, it was like the Misfits and Agent Orange and all these kind of funky bands. And, you know, I wasn't from Orange County when I was a kid, but I was close enough to it. And that was a circle of, like, a lot of music came from there, from that whole era. All those bands like TSOL and Agent Orange, and they were all sort of local, you know. And when I was a kid, I just thought they were awesome, you know. Like, wow, that's amazing. You could go to the swap meet and buy, like, a TSOL poster. I was like, this, you know, they must be, they're like Michael Jackson. They're enormous, you know. I just didn't know that they worked.
Yeah. That's awesome. So I know Hatch sent me some conversation notes he had had with you. So I know you went to a Christian high school. So did you grow up religious, or did you just end up at a Christian school? Or
No. My parents was a religious household. I went to public school until I was around fifth grade. And I got in a little bit of trouble. So my parents put me into private school, which by default was a Christian school because my parents were Christian. So so I finished out, you know, sixth grade through all of my high school through what was a private Christian school. In retrospect, you know, looking back, it probably was a lot better for me. At the time, I really didn't like it. I didn't appreciate it. But looking back now, it's probably best. And it's just a smaller, more condensed. There's fewer kids. You kind of know, you know, my graduating class, I think I had like 70 people or something, you know, compared to some giant public school where there's like 1,500 people or whatever. So it was just smaller. And it had interesting aspects, you know what I mean? It had really good kids. It had a lot of wealthy families because it was expensive. So it had, like, you had like wealthy kids, you had really good kids, and you also had like the worst, super, super bad kids who got kicked out of public school, and then by default they had to go to private school because they had nowhere else to go. So you kind of had a weird mix of these kids, and I enjoyed it. I mean, you know, I don't know, looking back, being in high school was literally just so easy. I just, you know, I wish I could just do that now. It'd be fantastic.
Yeah. And then back in high school, that was where you met the Martin brothers, Jason, right?
Yeah, Jason attended the same high school I did. I was, I can't remember if I'm 1 or 2 years prior to him, but we were there at the same time, and he was just a new kid. And I don't know why. I really don't even remember why. I talked to him one day. We hung out. He liked music. I don't know. It was just a nice friendship and a melding, and we both liked music, so we just started hanging out. And, you know, I met Ronnie by default because it was Jason's brother, and that's it. I mean, we just, you know, it's high school. You just, that's all you do, really, just hang out.
That's cool. That's cool. Were you playing any instruments at this time, or were you just, like, a fan?
No, I really wasn't playing any instruments. When I met Jason, they were playing in the band Morales Forest, which is, you know, the other Morales Forest. So when I met him, they were doing that. So same thing. When you're a kid, you know, I was like, oh my gosh, like this guy is like playing in a band and they have shows. You know, this is bananas. So we were just hanging out doing that. I didn't start playing guitar. Probably until like late high school, I started playing guitar.
Velvet Blue Music started in 1996. I know you did not join Starflyer until sometime between 97 and 98. Is that correct?
To be honest, I have no idea. I don't know.
Okay. What is the relation to you being in? Because you were in both Starflyer and Joy Electric at the same time. Kind of right around the same time.
When I first met them, they were doing Morales Forest together. And then right after that, they was like they just got their deal. They were doing Dance House Children stuff. Mm-hmm. So I actually played a few shows with Dance House Children, playing keys. And Jason didn't play in that band that all that long, I don't think. I don't remember exactly, but I ended up, you know, being with Ronnie and doing Dance House Children stuff. That's the first band I really started playing in, and where, you know, we, like, for Rainbow Rider, like, we went on tour and stuff, you know? Like, we would go away from home, and we went on tour with the band Mortal for, it seemed like a long time. It's probably like just a few weeks, but it seemed like a long time. I did that stuff first. So I was playing in Rainbow Rider. The timing's weird. I don't remember. I think I was just playing in Joy Electric. And at some point in time, when Starflyer was going on tour with the Prayer Chain, I went on tour with Jason, not just for fun, basically, because he had really no band at that time. So he had said, "Hey, Cloud, you know, I'm going on tour with this thing. I just have this hired guy for bass and drums or whatever. Would you just come and hang out?" And, you know, I don't even remember what the arrangement was, but it was like, you know, "I'll pay for your food" or whatever. I don't even remember.
Mm-hmm.
So we went on tour. And then on that tour, I decided, like, you know what? I'm like, Jason, you know, you're not, you need to, like, sell T-shirts and stickers, and, like, you got to do other stuff to, like, be more active. And we just had kind of weird conversations, and then there was, like, a lot of gaps in the tour. The tour, I mean, it was booked. The shows that were booked well, but there was a lot of holes in it.
Sure.
And I was like, man, why are we, like, taking... How come we're, like, in New York and we've just taken, like, 2 days off? Like, why do you do that, you know? And he'd be like, I don't know, man. If I could play shows, I would. And I'm like, okay, well, I can take care of that. I'll just book us places. So I started just booking and filling in holes, and that just led to me doing Starflyer stuff. And then that kind of became, like, hey, you know, Cloud, you should just come on tour and you'll help us and we'll sell more merchandise and then, you know, you can help us book shows or whatever. It just became this kind of weird thing where it was just helping the whole project. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then actually playing in the band was not really until later. It was like right after Americana was recorded. And I don't remember exactly why Eric was no longer in the band. I don't know. I really don't remember, but for whatever reason, there was no bass player available. And so Jason was like, "What do you want to do? We got to get a guy to play bass." I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Why don't you learn how to play bass?" And I'm like, "Well, I don't know. I don't play bass." And he's like, "Well, what do you think?" And then it was really just sort of like a managerial kind of thing. And I decided, like, you know what? Actually, if I played bass, then we wouldn't have to pay for a bass player. And we could all make a little more money. So I basically learned how to play bass just to do that, just to save the pay of one other person on tour. And that's really, like, the honest to goodness, that is the reason why I started playing the band.
So you were playing in Dance House Children with Ronnie before that, like back when he was playing shows. I'm gonna back way up, and maybe this is convoluted. How did you get involved with Dance House Children? And I assume you're playing keys and synthesizers. How did you come around to playing synths in that band? And you said you just played guitar light in high school.
It was just from being friends with Jason and Ronnie, you know, when I was in high school. And we would go to his house after school. And they had a little studio, which was kind of cool, at their house. And so I met Ronnie, and then, you know, there was, like, drums and guitar and bass and stuff in there. And then after school, we'd go in there, and I didn't really play anything very well. So sometimes we would just jam, or we would just pick cover songs. Sometimes I would sing, and then they would play or whatever. And then when I could kind of play, I would try to play along. It just kind of morphed into that. And then, you know, it's like you're in a band, and you need some guy with you, and there's a guy you kind of like already, and he's easygoing, and you're like, you know, whatever, Cloud could probably play this part, so let's just do it.
Sure.
It's just kind of opportunity, you know?
Sure. I guess maybe my question is, you said you morphed from, you know, Dance House Children into Joy Electric. your first public appearance with Joy Electric, at least from like album artwork and music videos, was Robot Rock. Was that something contractually with Tooth and Nail, or just kind of the natural progression of the way things worked?
I think it's just the way things worked. I mean, I wish I was better with the timeline of everything.
Sure.
I mean, Ronnie went from basically Rainbow Rider, which was, you know, like basically the last dance house thing, straight into Joy Electric. I really don't remember what I was doing at that point in time. I really wasn't. I remember him telling me about being signed at Tooth and Nail and doing this new record and doing the new band and all this stuff. I just wasn't involved with it at that point. So I really couldn't tell you when I started playing Joy Electric shows. I really don't remember, to be honest. Robot Rock, okay. Obviously, you know, things were really in concrete at that point, but I don't remember. I just don't remember when we started playing shows, for what records they were. Probably like Weird Music Makers, I would guess.
Yeah, I feel like there was something around that time where you were involved, where I saw you. But yeah, which is an interesting time frame to be like, you know, Robot Rock was 97 and Fashion Focus, which is your first Starfly record, which is 98. So roughly the same time frame with both bands, right, being involved in Tooth and Nail. Which at that time, by 97, you already had Velvet Blue Music. So what was it like trying to work a label and being involved in Tooth and Nail at the same time?
I think it made it easier, honestly, because when I first started the label, the outlet that Starflyer and Joy Electric both provided me was very cool. And then we would go on tour, you know, sometimes I wouldn't bring like everything, but you know, I'd bring a few things and I would sell them at the table, or I would meet other people and tell them I'm doing this label or whatever. I think the whole thing was just sort of a community that was building, you know what I mean? Being on Tooth and Nail was great, you know what I mean? It was nice exposure, and they, you know, spent money on the record and did stuff. So, I don't know.
Okay.
I feel like it was all just kind of intermingling at that time, you know what I mean? It was just kind of hand in hand.
Well, maybe that maybe leads to my next question. What was it like for you running Velvet Blue Music at that time, where, you know, you were doing Cornerstone and Purple Door, and I don't know if Venue, Starflyer, or Joy Electric were playing at this time, but let's just say you had church shows and you had your table with Velvet Blue releases, and people are coming up to buy records, and it's like you've just played this set and you're at a Christian festival, but you're also selling Lassie Foundation CDs where, you know, they say fuck on the record, or John Wilkes Kissing Booth where there's profanity. Like, what was it like being in that gray space of like being like in this Christian world but not having an exclusive Christian label and trying to like balance both? Was that a weird thing, or was it just
I mean, me personally, I never really felt like it was a weird thing. If it, you know, it might have been weird to some certain individuals. To me, you know, I don't know. It just kind of felt natural, really. I mean, like I said, by default, you know, most of my friends were Christians because, you know, that's what I was doing. So on the offshoot that I found a band that I liked and we did other stuff on the side and whatever, I don't know. I don't feel like anyone ever felt gypped like I pushed something forward and said it was something it wasn't. So,
right.
I don't know. I think a lot of other people make a much bigger deal about that, but to me, it was just like we were playing shows and making music and putting out music, and I don't know. The two worlds are always a little bit like separated to me, but everyone wants to kind of make them intertwined. I just never thought it was that big a deal, really.
Okay. Yeah, I wasn't. It's not to be judgmental or.
No. I understand. I understand. I mean, when people talk about, like, you know, the Christian music world, I understand there's definitely some, you know, weird aspect to it. I understand that. I just don't know if we were really that so deep and involved in it that it crossed over to me, you know what I mean?
Sure. I just didn't know if there was, like, you would get emails from parents where people would complain that, like, my kid bought this record at a Christian festival and it has a profane word on it or something, right? Because I remember, like, hanging out with...
That didn't really happen to me so much. I think it's probably because kind of the music, the genres we were involved in, you know what I mean?
Sure, yeah. Fans were a little more mature or older.
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, we weren't really dabbling in, like, pop punk, you know what I mean? Again, like, you know, our stuff wasn't really readily available in a Christian bookstore, or I'm not to say that, you know, in the beginning we sold stuff to a lot of stores and things, but nothing I thought was overtly offensive or, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I never had any problem with it, but it's just an interesting world to be a part of, to be not both sides seeing it, right? But like Prayer Chain was like a very CCM band, and Lassie Foundation was not, but they like cross-pollinated, right? And you I feel like the Velvet Blue music forms at the time, there was a lot of talk of like the Christian indie scene that, like, whether for better or for worse, like Pedro the Lion and Velvet Blue music had like less like bred this scene of like people who were like, it's like, yeah, these Christian indie bands, but everybody was like on this like outskirt kind of questioning side of things, right? So,
and I mean, and then think about, I mean, you got to keep in mind too, it was really just the time frame of everything too. I mean, yeah. If you fast forward to today, you know what I mean? We've got like these, you know, quote unquote hip churches that have these praise and worship beer nights. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So we have large churches that are like, we're going to meet at a bar and we're going to do this new craft beer sampling and then we're going to sing praise songs. If you would have tried something like that like 15 years ago, people would have gone nuts. You know what I mean?
Right.
So it's just a lot of it is just the time frame involved.
Right. I agree. I remember like Purple Door, I don't even know what year it was, but like talking to Jason and both of us like in the back, like behind the stages, like smoking cigarettes. And it's like, that would not have been acceptable like in front of anybody, but just like... two people hanging out back, it was fine. So
I mean today, you know, man, you Cutlass might as well, like, you know, just be smoking a bowl at, you know, at the Harvest Crusade. No one cares, you know what I mean? It's just turned such a weird corner, like it makes me uncomfortable. It's just turned so far the other way now that no one cares about anything.
What you will learn in time, you'll see it my way. I have felt what you will feel. This will make sense someday. I got the message, I got your card. Leave me all alone. You heard me the first time, it wasn't a joke. It always ends this way.
What has it been like trying to balance kind of the early Christian side of the label and what have you seen an evolution, or is it just like you're just signing bands you like and it doesn't matter and you're just riding the wave?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, in that respect, again, like to me, it just, I don't know, it just really
it's just didn't, music.
It's just music. I mean, I don't think I've evolved or changed, or I don't think I'm doing anything differently than I did like 20 years ago. It's, you know, it's all the same, really.
About some specific releases here. How did you get hooked up with Branson and doing their 7-inch?
That's an excellent question. I think it's probably going to stem from Matt Traxler, who was always really cool, really super nice to me. He was running a mail order catalog, I think. And so he would take some of our releases and, I don't know. I just must have came up one day, like, do you want to do a Branson 7-inch? So I probably said, yeah. And you know, the 7-inch really did actually really, really well.
And that was, like, pre them on Deep Elm, too. So it was, like,
yeah, right, they were a band that was really out of place for us, but Revelation Records was from Huntington Beach. I mean, that was basically, like, punk and hardcore, a bunch of straight edge stuff. But, they were sort of a force to be reckoned with. They were cool. And so I had a friend who worked there, and he would carry our stuff in the catalog, although it didn't do very well. And then when I told him we were doing the Branson 7-inch, he was, like, all excited, like, oh, awesome. And I remember he took just tons of them from us. And so I remember thinking, like, well, this is really cool. Like, I'm happy. Like, finally we did something that's, you know, I feel like maybe we did something just out of what we normally do that people like. So I thought it was cool. And everyone in Branson, I mean, those are, like, the nicest guys ever. Yeah, I mean, it fit on the label. I mean, it was maybe a little out of place, but it fit in, and it was fine, and, you know, it was cool.
And then how did the Staves Acred SMRs split come about? Just a Tooth and Nail connection with Staves Acred, and Denison was already on your label, so?
Yeah, I mean, Staves Acred, I've been friends with those guys forever. I mean, me and Dirk worked together for a really long time. Dirk's, like, one of the actual only VBM employees.
Okay.
He worked for me for a long time, and then we had a great time. We were booking a lot of bands together. We were, you know, folding catalogs, mailing junk out, whatever. Dirk was always super cool. So it was just kind of a natural thing. You know, it just, you know, same thing. It's just someone you hang out with and your friends, and it's like, hey, I got a band, I got a label. All right, let's do this thing. You know what I mean?
Played in Joy Electric up until the White Songbook came out, and you toured on that record a little bit. What led you to leaving Joy Electric?
Honestly, I just ran out of the time. That's all. I was, I was touring a lot between being in Starflyer and being in Joy Electric and Pony Express. You know, we didn't do too many shows, but we still would go out on tour and do things. It was just like I was just gone all the time, and it was hard. It was getting hard to juggle everything, and the label at that point had a lot of stuff going on. So I just felt like that was the easiest thing for me to remove myself that wouldn't be, like, disastrous. Like, it'd just be no big deal. Ronnie could just find someone else. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's all. It was just, you know, I just, you know, something had to get cut, and it was just Joy Electric, that's all. No ill will, or, you know, nothing bad happened.
So you were in Starflyer through Portuguese Blues, which means, and I know from Velvet Blue Music, you got to work with the incredible Richard Swift, who just passed away. What was getting to work with Richard like?
Well, when he was in Starflyer, it was just fun, you know what I mean? It was just the funnest time, I think, in Starflyer was when it was Richard and Lenz and me and Jason. I think it's, like, I think it's the most band that the band has ever been, kind of, you know? And
sure. For
me, it was just fun. I mean, I've always said I'm just, like, the least talented guy in the thing, so it took everything I had to just try to keep up with the three of them, you know what I mean? So if it was just even passable, I was just happy. And Swift is just like just a really talented guy, just all around talented guy. You know, all the stuff we put out together on Velvet Blue, he had a great creative input into it. And I don't know, we always got along really well. I just almost just consider him a friend, you know, above artist or relation or client or whatever, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
He's just, I don't know, there's a small group of, like, just really talented people that somehow I've aligned myself with or been around, and, you know, Richard's definitely part of that group.
What was it like for you to see, and I'm sure you saw, Lars Got Rich at NPR Music referenced the Velvet Blue 7 Inches after Swift's passing as a memorial to him?
I think it's really cool, honestly. I'm glad for all the recognition that Richard's gotten recently. I feel like, you know, a large part of me is like, you know, you guys didn't seem to care so much before, you know what I mean? I mean, it's a lot of nice new press. I don't know if you saw the recent, like, Rolling Stone article.
I did, yeah, yeah.
It's very nice, you know, it's cool. I just wish that there was a lot of people who would have taken notice.
I know this is hard, like, just for me personally, like, when Lars put that NPR Music article out referencing those 7 Inches, is that was, like, his go-to, like, in the news, is, like, that's what he listened to. Like, for me, it was the same thing, because, like, yeah, Buildings in America and, like, nothing to do with Foxy Boxing. Like, those were the 7 Inches, like, when I heard the news that I put back on, because that was always my connection to Richard, was the Velvet Blue 7-inch releases. Like, that's always how I remembered him, so.
Yeah, and I felt like Lars's thing was really sweet and, you know, totally legitimate, and I don't want to lump him in with some of the other stuff, because I think he truly was a fan.
Yeah,
there's just so much more news and stuff about him now that I just wish people would have taken a little more notice of him previously, you know what I mean?
I'm hungry, hungover, you're an angel, I'm coming over, but please don't laugh, don't say that it's okay. You're a plane crash, blister fever. You're a liar, a believer. But please don't laugh. Don't say that it's okay. I cut your name from your mother's heart. I won't be late and I won't be caught. Try not to be someone to love. Didn't mean to bleed, but it's so damn tough. I played your harp, but I broke 2 strings. Jesus Christ, you're a lovely thing.
Have you had any interaction with Lars? Because I know, like, he highlighted the Fine China release you did last year, which is amazing, and, like, you weren't involved in it, but Starflyer, like, have you had interactions with Lars and his NPR Music stuff?
I email him occasionally. I think he's a great writer. Obviously, he's really good at what he does. I email him occasionally. I try to, like, not take advantage of this weird connection we have, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'm not like friends with him. Like, we don't talk on the phone or text or chat or anything like that. So,
sure.
You know, I think he's done a great job. I'm really happy with the stuff of ours he's covered, and yeah, that's it.
You left Starflyer after Portuguese Blues. If you're willing to talk about it, what led to you leaving Starflyer?
At the time, I was just really focused on doing the label stuff. You know what I mean? And
yeah.
Starflyer is obviously essentially Jason's band, you know what I mean? It's his band. I'd spent a really long time in the band, and I just, our views were just different on what we wanted to do. You know, I just wanted to make it a real band and go on tour and play shows all the time, and that just wasn't what Jason wanted to do, you know what I mean? It was hard to commit so much to something that maybe wasn't exactly what I wanted it to be, you know what I mean? But it wasn't my band, so it didn't matter, really.
Right. Sure.
But, I mean, that's basically why I stopped playing in the band. I just, it was just, I had a little frustration, and it was taking up a lot of time, which was okay, but it was starting to take up a lot of time and then not produce the things that I wanted it to produce. And me and Jason had a long period of not talking and stuff like that. But that's all gone now, and I consider Jason one of just my really, really best friends now, you know. So he lives real close to me. We see each other a lot. We had a weird period in our lives where we were absent from each other. But that's all gone now, and I think things are cool, you know what I mean? He's obviously an extremely talented guy, so he's going to do what he's going to do. And I don't know, we have a lot in common on a lot of other things, you know, music aside, you know what I mean?
There seems to be a similar strain with, like, Frank Lent, where he put out Conquest Slaughter on the label, and then it was like he was estranged from the label, and then, like, Welcome Back. Was there a weird period with Lens too? Did that stem from Starflyer stuff or other stuff? If you don't have to talk about that again.
Lens has just had some sort of crazy personal things in his life, you know what I mean? I don't think he was really ever estranged from the label. He just had some tension, you know, tension with me. He's had some definite tension being in Starflyer. He's, Lens is a very tumultuous man. He's an extremely talented man, of course. He has a great heart, but he's also very, very tumultuous, you know what I mean? He has issues with people, and it comes up, and so that's, you know, I'm older now. I just get it. That's part of who Lens is, and that's fine. And same thing, you know what I mean? I love Lens. I'd go, you know what I mean? I'd go out to lunch with him tomorrow, and we'd hang out and have a great time. I'd text with him all the time. We're actually working on music stuff together right now. I mean, that's just who he is, you know what I mean? Lens is a person I would incorporate into the small group of people I know that are extremely talented. Lens is one of them.
Have you heard of the man with the curse upon his head? Said he'd rather be a victim than confused. It appears at his birth that his death
I'm going to focus on you and Pony Express, which is a band I love and a band I, like, people don't know enough about. Your last Pony Express record was, I mean, you put out Oddballs in 2005, but you also put out Fraud, which was the last new music in 2005. When you and me talked on a different podcast, on a much shorter podcast years ago, because I was still living in DC at the time, you said there was a new... There was possibility of new Pony Express. What do we got on Pony Express, man? How do we have to make this happen? Me and Hatch talk about this every time we hang out.
I know. I think it just comes down to time, really. I mean, the most important people would be, like, you know, Lens and Martin and Dooley, you know, and Swift when he was here. They've all been bugging me about it forever. I guess I just got to buckle down and just commit to it one day, and I don't know. It's like it's a fun project, and I really like doing it when time is available. You know what I mean? I think it's hard. It's not my life, but, you know, when you're, like, a parent and you have a job and you've got all the stuff, and then you're going to come home at 5 o'clock and, you know, between 5 o'clock and eight, right before dinner, you're supposed to have, like, this creative spurt when you're going to write a song or do whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's how I feel. I feel like constrained. Like, I just don't have the leisure time to sit around and strum guitar and I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm just making a bunch of excuses, but I don't know. You're not the first person who's asked me. That's for sure.
It's the story of our time.
Velvet Blue, you've had a pretty successful, at least abstract mainstream. I don't know how it relates to sales, but with the Fine China record and Lee Bozeman, and I know Soda Shop and Telegraph Canyon have all gotten some play. What's the future and the outlook of the label looking like right now? I know you've come a long way from kind of a Christian side project independent label to now being more of a indie mainstream, whatever that means, kind of label. What's the future look like for you?
I mean, kind of what you were mentioning, I decided a couple of years ago, basically, I would kind of return to my roots, you know what I mean? I've teetered on the fence a lot of times about doing or not doing the label anymore. I mean, there's a lot of things in my life I'd like to accomplish. And the label, although it's like a labor of love, it's still very time intensive and takes a lot of effort. But in my teetering a couple years ago, I decided, like, you know what, I'm just going to return to my roots and kind of go back to where I came from. And so that's why we reissued that the Plugged on vinyl. Yeah, we started working with Fine China again. We started working with Lee Bozeman. I had reached out to a couple of the other older artists. And I just wanted to kind of just go back to where I came from. You know what I mean? And we did a new map EP. So that was kind of at that juncture in time, I'm like, you know what? I did something cool in the beginning. I just want to return to that and do that again.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, actually successful. At this point in time now, I'm a little past the nostalgia, I guess. And so we're just moving forward. I think I'm just doing the same things I've always done. Just hopefully after all this time, I'm a little better at it. As long as there's people who appreciate and are wanting or waiting for us to release certain things, then I try to keep doing it. You know what I mean? And financially, as long as it makes sense, then I just do what I do, basically.
I think you posted, I think it was you, Lee Bozeman's working on new music, and Doug Burr always has something up his sleeve, and you got the new Leme of the Earth record coming out shortly.
I'm always trying to, like, kind of taper things down, and then things come up, and I just, you know, I guess I just can't say no, you know what I mean? I'm just too excited, so I'm like, oh yeah, I totally want to do that, let's do that. And then next thing I know, I've got like all this stuff and it's like a full calendar, you know?
Thanks for listening to As the Story Grows. Our theme song was written and composed by the legendary Bob Nana. If you like what you hear, subscribe on iTunes and give the show a rating and review. If you'd like to support the show financially, click on the Patreon link at asthestorygrows.com. If you enjoyed this episode, share it on social media with your friends. Much appreciated, and thanks for listening.
I never felt so young and alive as when I'm diving into a tomb. And now I'm learning as I learn.
That's just attacking. Never.